At length we have gotten rid of Lord Hillsborough, he exulted to William. Hillsborough, in turn, called Franklin one of the most mischievous men in England. Yet, in that odd way they had of cloaking their enmity in occasional bouts of feigned cordiality, the two men made peace when they happened upon each other at Oxford the following summer. Hillsborough made a point of bowing and complimenting Franklin. In return for this extravagance, Franklin reported to William, I complimented him on his son's performance in the theatre, though indeed it was but indifferent. So that account was settled. For as people say when they are angry, if he strikes me, I'll strike him again. I sometimes think it might be right to say, if he flatters me, I'll flatter him again. The Hutchinson Letters. There has lately fallen into my hands part of a correspondence that I have reason to believe laid the foundation of most, if not all, our present grievances. With these fateful words, written to his Massachusetts supporter, Thomas Cushing, in December 1772, Franklin stirred up a tempest that would lead to his final break with Britain. Enclosed was a batch of letters, six of them written by Massachusetts Governor Thomas Hutchinson, a Boston merchant from an old Puritan family who had once been Franklin's friend when they had put together the Albany Plan for Colonial Union in 1754. The letters had been given to Franklin surreptitiously by an unnamed member of Parliament, and he forwarded them to Cushing with the injunction that they not be made public. Hutchinson's letters were filled with advice on how to subdue colonial unrest. There must be an abridgment of what are called English liberties, he had written. When they were published in Boston, John and Samuel Adams, with the acquiescence of Thomas Cushing, made sure that they were, despite Franklin's request that they not be. They stoked the growing fury of the radical patriots there. This was the opposite of what Franklin had intended. His aim was to calm the rebellious sentiments by privately showing Cushing and a few other leaders that England's misguided policies had been caused by bad advice from people such as Hutchinson, more than by unreasonable hatred for America. The letters, he believed, might even promote a tendency towards a reconciliation, which is what, he later claimed, I earnestly wished. Indeed, most of Franklin's missives in early 1773 were designed to decrease tensions. I hope that great care will be taken to keep our people quiet, he wrote Cushing in March, since nothing is more wished for by our enemies than that by insurrections we would give a good pretense for increasing the military among us and putting us under more severe restraints. When the Massachusetts Assembly passed a resolution declaring that it was not subservient to Parliament, Franklin similarly urged the English to refrain from overreacting. In my opinion, it would be better and more prudent to take no notice of it, he wrote Colonial Secretary Lord Dartmouth, who had replaced Hillsborough. It is words only. To make his point, without stirring up more animosity, Franklin reverted to his youthful love of satire in two anonymous propaganda pieces he wrote for the English papers in September 1773. The first was entitled, Rules by which a great empire may be reduced to a small one, noting that an ancient sage, it was the Greek admiral and ruler Themistocles, had once boasted that he knew how to turn a little city into a great one, the essay listed 20 ways to do the reverse to an empire. Among them, in the first place, gentlemen, you are to consider that a great empire, like a great cake, is most easily diminished at the edges. Take special care the provinces are never incorporated with the mother country, that they do not enjoy the same common rights, the same privileges in commerce, and that they are governed by severer laws, all of your enacting, without allowing them any share in the choice of legislators. However peaceably your colonies have submitted to your government, shown their affection to your interest, and patiently borne their grievances, you are to suppose them always inclined to revolt, and treat them accordingly. Quarter troops among them, who by their insolence may provoke the rising of mobs, like the husband who uses his wife ill from suspicion, you may in time convert your suspicions into realities. Whenever the injured come to the capital with complaints, punish such suitors with long delay, enormous expense, and a final judgment in favor of the oppressor. Resolve to harass them with novel taxes. They will probably complain to your parliaments that they are taxed by a body in which they have no representative, and that this is contrary to common right. Let the parliaments flout their claims and treat the petitioners with utmost contempt. The list, reflecting the indignities that had been perpetrated on America, went on at length. Send them prodigals and pettifogging lawyers to govern them. Perplex their commerce with infinite regulations. Appoint insolent tax collectors. And garrison your troops in their homes rather than on the frontier where they can be of use. If you follow these rules for diminishing your colonies, the essay concluded, you will get rid of the trouble of governing them. It was signed QED, the initials for the Latin phrase quod erat demonstrandum, which was to be demonstrated, used at the end of a philosophical argument to note the proposition was proved. 2 weeks later, Franklin published an even broader parody of Britain's treatment of America, an edict by the King of Prussia. A thinly disguised hoax, it purported to be a declaration issued by King Frederick II. Whereas the Germans had long ago created the first settlements in England and had lately protected it in the war against France, they had decided that a revenue should be raised from said colonies in Britain. So Prussia was levying 4.5% duties on all English imports and exports, and it was prohibiting the creation of any further manufacturing plants in England. The edict added that the felons in German jails shall be emptied out and sent to England for the better peopling of that country. Lest anyone be so thick as to miss the point, it concluded by noting that all of these measures should be considered just and reasonable in England because they were copied from the rules imposed by the British Parliament on the American colonies. When his edict appeared, Franklin had the pleasure of being a guest at the country estate of Lord Le Despencer, who, as Postmaster General of Britain, was Franklin's boss and had become his friend. Le Despencer was, in Van Doren's words, a seasoned old sinner who had restored a former abbey where he gathered dissolute friends for, as rumor had it, blasphemous rites and an occasional orgy. Franklin befriended him in 1772, when Le Despencer had become a bit more respectable, and helped him compile a simplified and deistic version of the Book of Common Prayer. In his reformist zeal, Franklin had recently written a more concise version of the Lord's Prayer as well. Franklin was chatting in the breakfast parlor with Le Despencer and others when a guest came running into us out of breath with the morning papers and exclaimed, "Here's the King of Prussia claiming a right to this kingdom." Franklin feigned innocence as the story was read. "Damn his impudence!" one of those present proclaimed. But as the reading neared its end, another guest began to sense the hoax. "I'll be hanged if this is not some of your American jokes upon us," he said to Franklin. The reading, Franklin noted, ended with abundance of laughing and a general verdict that it was a fair hit. Franklin proudly described the parodies in a letter to William. He preferred the one on rules, he said, because of the quantity and variety of the matter contained and a kind of spirited ending of each paragraph. But others preferred the edict. He boasted, "I am not suspected as the author, except by one or two friends, and have heard the edict spoken of in the highest terms as the keenest and severest piece that has appeared here for a long time." His letter to William, however, was not wholly jovial. Slowly, inevitably, a rift was widening between the increasingly radical American agent and the royal governor with upper-class friends and aspirations. "Parliament has no right to make any law whatever binding on the colonies," Franklin argued in the letter. "I know your sentiments differ from mine on these subjects. You are a thorough government man." In the cockpit. "I want much to hear how that tea is received," Franklin worriedly wrote a friend in late 1773. Parliament had added to the indignity of its continued tariff on tea by passing new regulations that gave the corrupt East India Company a virtual monopoly over the trade. Franklin urged calm. But the radicals of Boston, led by Sam Adams and the Sons of Liberty, did not. On December 16, 1773, after a mass rally in the Old South Church, some 50 patriots, disguised as Mohawk Indians, went down to the wharves and dumped 342 chests of tea worth £10,000 into the sea. Franklin was shocked by the act of violent injustice on our part. His sympathies for the colonial cause were not enough to overcome his basic conservatism about rabble rule. "The shareholders of the East India Company are not our adversaries," he declared. "It was wrong to destroy private property." As Boston was having its tea party, England was being roiled by recriminations from the release of the purloined Hutchinson letters. Franklin had expressed surprise that "my name has not been heard in connection with the affair," and added his "wish it may continue unknown." But in December, two men engaged in an inconclusive duel in Hyde Park after one accused the other of leaking the letters. When a rematch seemed imminent, Franklin felt he had to step forward. "I alone am the person who obtained and transmitted to Boston the letters in question," he wrote in a letter to the London Chronicle on Christmas Day. But he did not apologize. "These were not private letters between friends," he claimed, "but were written by public officers to persons in public station. They were designed to incense the mother country against her colonies." Franklin's role in publicizing purloined copies gave ammunition to those in Britain who saw him as a troublemaker. In early January, he was summoned to appear before the Privy Council in a famed room known as the Cockpit, because cockfights had been held there during the time of Henry VIII. The ostensible reason was to hear testimony on a petition from the Massachusetts Assembly to remove Hutchinson from the governorship. The questioning, however, quickly focused on whether the letters from Hutchinson, which had been presented as evidence by Franklin, were private and how they were obtained. Franklin was surprised to find at the hearing the Solicitor General, Alexander Wedderburn, a nasty and ambitious prosecutor who had voted against the repeal of the Stamp Act and possessed, in the words of his Prime Minister Lord North, an accommodating conscience. It was clear that the political issue of the petition against Hutchinson was being turned into a legal case against Franklin for making his letters public. The government, Wedderburn said pointedly, had the right of inquiring how they were obtained. "I thought this had been a matter of politics and not of law," Franklin told the committee, "and I have not brought any counsel." "Dr. Franklin may have the assistance of counsel, or go on without it as he shall choose," said one of the lords on the council.
"I desire to have counsel," Franklin replied.
Asked how long he needed to prepare his case, Franklin answered,
3 weeks.
It was not a fun 3 weeks for Franklin. News of the Boston Tea Party reached England, further undermining sympathy for the American cause. He was called an incendiary, and, he noted, "the papers were filled with invectives against me." There were even hints that he might be jailed. His fellow shareholders in the Walpole Group expressed fear that his involvement would hurt their cause for a land grant. So he wrote them that, "I do therefore desire that you will strike my name out of the list of your associates." The letter, it should be noted, was cleverly phrased so that he did not in fact actually resign. He remained a secret shareholder without voting rights. When the Privy Council reconvened in the cockpit on January 29, 1774, the showdown made the original use of that room seem tame. "All the courtiers were invited," Franklin noted, "as to an entertainment." The packed crowd of councillors and spectators ranged from the Archbishop of Canterbury to the revenge-hungry Lord Hillsborough, with but a few friends of Franklin, including Edmund Burke, Lord Le Despencer, and Joseph Priestley, there to lend him moral support. Franklin later said it was like a bull-baiting. Wedderburn, that man of sharp tongue, was both clever and brutal in his hour-long tirade. He called Franklin the prime conductor, an allusion to his electric fame, of the agitation against the British government. Instead of focusing on the merits of the Massachusetts petition, he homed in on the purloined letters. "Private correspondence has hitherto been held sacred," he raged. "He has forfeited all the respect of societies and of men." With a zinging wit, he added, "He will henceforth call it a libel to be called a man of letters." In addition to wit, there was ample invective. Burke called Wedderburn's attack a furious philippic, and another spectator called it a torrent of virulent abuse. Amid his fury, Wedderburn scored some valid points. Ridiculing Franklin's argument that Hutchinson's desire to keep the letters secret was an admission he had something to hide, the solicitor correctly noted that Franklin had kept his own involvement in the affair secret for almost a year. "He kept himself concealed until he nearly occasioned the murder of an innocent man," he said, referring to the duel in Hyde Park. Pounding the council table until, according to Jeremy Bentham, it groaned under the assault, Wedderburn accused Franklin of wanting to be governor himself. The crowd cheered and jeered, but Franklin betrayed not the slightest emotion as he stood at the edge of the room, wearing a plain suit made of blue Manchester velvet. Edward Bancroft, a friend of Franklin's, who later spied on him in Paris, described his behavior. The doctor was dressed in a full suit of spotted Manchester velvet and stood conspicuously erect without the smallest movement of any part of his body. The muscles of his face had been previously composed as to afford a placid, tranquil expression of countenance, and he did not suffer the slightest alteration of it to appear. At the finale of his speech, Wedderburn called Franklin forward as a witness, and declared, I am ready to examine him.
The official records of the proceedings notes, Dr. Franklin being present remained silent, but declared by his counsel that he did not choose to be examined. Silence had often been his best weapon, making him seem wise or benign or serene. On this occasion, it made him look stronger than his powerful adversaries, contemptuous rather than contrite, condescending rather than cowed. The Privy Council, as expected, rejected the Massachusetts petition against Hutchinson, calling it groundless, vexatious, and scandalous. The next day, Franklin was informed by letter that his old friend Lord Le Despencer found it necessary to remove him from his job as American postmaster. This infuriated him, for he was proud of having made the colonial system efficient and profitable, and he wrote a terse note to William suggesting that he leave his governorship and become a farmer. It is an honester and more honorable because a more independent employment. To his sister Jane, he was more ruminative. I am deprived of my office. Don't let this give you any uneasiness. You and I have almost finished the journey of life. We are now but a little way from home, and have enough in our pocket to pay the post-chaises. Fearing that he might be arrested or his papers confiscated, Franklin slipped down to the Thames near Craven Street a few days after the cockpit hearing. Carrying a trunk of his papers, he took a boat upriver to a friend's house in Chelsea, where he laid low for a few days. When the danger passed, he returned to Craven Street and resumed receiving guests. "I do not find that I have lost a single friend on the occasion," he noted. "All have visited me repeatedly with affectionate assurances of unaltered respect." At their request, he wrote a very long and detailed account of the Hutchinson affair, but then did not publish it, noting that such censures I have generally passed over in silence. He did, however, continue his torrent of anonymous publications. Indulging an atypical but given the circumstances understandable desire to be boastful, he wrote a semi-anonymous piece, signed Homo Trium Literarum, a man of letters, the insulting pun Wedderburn had hurled at him, that declared that the admirers of Dr. Franklin in England are much shocked at Mr. Wedderburn's calling him a thief. He noted that the French, in the preface to his scientific papers just published there, also called him a thief. To steal from the heaven its sacred fire, he taught. In an unsigned description of the cockpit hearings published in a Boston paper, he claimed of himself that the doctor came by these letters honorably. His intention in sending them was virtuous, to lessen the breach between Britain and the colonies. His satires and sarcasm became ever more biting. In one essay written after General Gage had been sent to replace Hutchinson as governor in Massachusetts, he suggested that Britain, without delay, introduce into North America a government absolutely and entirely military. That would so intimidate the Americans that they would happily submit to all taxes. When the colonists are drained of their last shilling, he added, they should be sold to the best bidder, such as Spain or France. In another piece, he proposed a policy for General Gage to assure that more rebels did not arise in America. All the males there be castrated. For good measure, the ringleaders, such as John Hancock and Sam Adams, should be shaved quite close. Among the side benefits, he added, were that it would be useful to the opera, and it would reduce the number of people emigrating from Britain to America. Once again, the question arose, why not finally head home? His wife was near death. He was a political outcast. Once again, he resolved to do so. As soon as he settled the post office accounts, he told friends, by May, he promised Richard Bache. And, once again, he ended up not returning. For the rest of 1774, Franklin stayed in England with little to do. No official business to conduct, no ministers to lobby. Even the king found it curious. "Where is Dr. Franklin?" His Majesty asked Lord Dartmouth that summer. "I believe, sir, he is in town. He was going to America, but I fancy he is not gone." "I heard," said the king, "he was going to Switzerland."
"I think," Lord Dartmouth replied, "there has been such a report."
In fact, he had stayed close to Craven Street, venturing out rarely, seeing mainly close friends. As he would write to his sister in September, "I have seen no minister since January, nor had the least communication with them." The breach with William. The impending clash between Britain and America inevitably foreshadowed a personal one between Franklin and his loyalist son. Tormented about the former prospect, Franklin remained callous about the latter. William, on the other hand, agonized mightily as he tried to balance his duties as a son with those of being the royal governor of New Jersey. In his letters to his father after the cockpit fight, he hoped to curry favor by flattering him, reassuring him, and cajoling him to come home. "Your popularity in this country, whatever it may be on the other side, is greatly beyond what it ever was," William wrote in May. "You may depend when you return here on being received with every mark of regard and affection." He made clear, however, that he had no intention of resigning his governorship, despite his father's occasional suggestions that he do so. Caught in the middle was the printer William Strawn, one of Franklin's closest friends in England, who had become a confidant of the younger Franklin as well. He urged William to be his own man, to stick to loyalist positions, and to let the ministers know that he would not let his father's views interfere with his allegiance to the government he served. William heeded the advice. Shortly after writing the solicitous letter to his father, he wrote one to Lord Dartmouth, the colonial secretary. "His Majesty may be assured that I will omit nothing in my power to keep this province quiet," he promised. Then he added pointedly, "No attachment or connection shall ever make me swerve from the duty of my station." Translation: his loyalty to his father would not tug him away from his loyalty to Britain. Lord Dartmouth promptly responded with reassurances. "I should do injustice to my own sentiments of your character and conduct in supposing you could be induced by any consideration whatever to swerve from the duty you owe the king." William went further than merely offering professions of fealty. He opened what he called a secret and confidential correspondence with Lord Dartmouth that provided information about American sentiments. Support was growing throughout the colonies to aid Massachusetts, he warned, in reaction to the British decision to blockade Boston's port. A meeting of colonial delegates, which would become known as the First Continental Congress, had been scheduled for Philadelphia in September. William made clear which side he was on. The proposed gathering, he declared, was absurd, if not unconstitutional, and he doubted that it would lead to a mass boycott of British goods. His father disagreed on all counts. He had been recommending a Continental Congress for more than a year. He felt strongly that it should call for a boycott, and he was confident that it would. "In that case," he wrote gleefully to William, "the present ministry will certainly be knocked up." He also chided William for clinging to his governorship, and typically cast the issue in pecuniary as well as political terms. By remaining dependent on the salary of a governor, said Franklin, he would never be able to pay off the debts he owed his father. In addition, the changing political climate meant, "You will find yourself in no comfortable situation, and perhaps wish you had soon disengaged yourself." It was signed simply, B. Franklin. Even though he knew his letters were being opened and read by British authorities, Franklin forcefully urged his American supporters to take a firm stand. The Continental Congress, he wrote, must vote immediately to stop all commerce with this country, both exports and imports, until you have obtained redress. At stake was no less than whether Americans and their endless generations shall enjoy the common rights of mankind, or be worse than Eastern slaves. In those days, when it could take up to 2 months for the mail to be delivered overseas, there were a lot of crossed letters. William continued to try to convince his father that a Continental Congress was a bad idea. "There is no foreseeing the consequences that may result from such a Congress. Instead, Bostonians should make restitution for the tea they destroyed, and then they might get their port opened in a few months." Franklin had actually expressed a few months earlier similar sentiments about how Bostonians would be prudent to pay restitution for their Tea Party. "Such a step will remove much of the prejudice now entertained against us," he had written Cushing in March. It infuriated him, however, to be given such a lecture by his son. And in September he wrote a crushing response rebutting William point by point. Britain had extorted many thousands of pounds from the colonies unconstitutionally. Of this money, they ought to make restitution. The argument ended in insult. "But you, who are a thorough courtier, see everything with government eyes." Franklin wrote his son again in October, making many of the same arguments and then turning personal. He pointedly noted that his son was behind in paying back the money he had loaned him over the years, and would not likely be able to do so if he remained a royal governor. For a while, there was no answer. Then, on Christmas Eve of 1774, William sent his father a letter of brutal sadness and pain. Deborah had died, with Franklin not there. "I came here on Thursday last to attend the funeral of my poor old mother, who died Monday," he began, referring to his stepmother. Franklin's dutiful and long-suffering wife had been pining away since her stroke 5 years earlier. "I find myself growing very feeble, very fast," she had written in 1772. For most of 1774, she had been too weak to write at all. Oblivious, Franklin had continued to send off short notes to her, some paternalistic and others businesslike, that contained breezy references to his own health, greetings from the Stevenson family, and admonitions for not writing him. "A very respectable number of the inhabitants were at the funeral," William continued. Clearly wanting his father to feel guilty, he described his last visit with Deborah that October. "She told me that she never expected to see you unless you returned this winter, that she was sure she would not live until next summer. I heartily wish you had happened to have come over in the fall, as I think her disappointment preyed a good deal on her spirits." At the end of the letter, William turned plaintive, as he beseeched his father to leave England. "You are looked upon with an evil eye in that country, and are in no small danger of being brought into trouble for your political conduct," William warned. "You had certainly better return while you are able to bear the fatigues of the journey to a country where the people revere you." He also ached to see his own son Temple, now 14, and he begged Franklin to bring him to America. "I hope to see you and him in the spring, and that you will spend some time with me." The Howe Chatham Secret Talks. As his wife was dying that December, Franklin was enjoying a flirtatious series of chess matches with a fashionable woman he had just met in London. But the games were not merely social. They were part of a secret last-ditch effort by some members of Britain's Whig opposition to stave off a revolution by the colonies. The process had begun in August, when he received a request to call on Lord Chatham, formerly William Pitt the Elder, who had served two stints as Prime Minister and been known as the Great Commoner until unwisely accepting a peerage as the Earl of Chatham. The great Whig orator was a steadfast supporter of America. By 1774, he was ailing and out of government. But he had decided to re-engage in public affairs as an outspoken opponent of Lord North and his policy of colonial repression. Lord Chatham received Franklin warmly, professed full support for the resistance by the colonies to British taxation, and said he hoped they would continue firm. Franklin responded by urging Chatham to join with other Whig wise men to oust the present set of bungling ministers and form a government that would restore the union and harmony between Britain and her colonies. That was not likely, Chatham said. There were too many in England who felt that there could be no further concessions, because America aimed at setting up for itself an independent state. America did not aim at independence, Franklin claimed. I assured him that, having more than once traveled almost from one end of the continent to the other, and kept a great variety of company, eating, drinking, and conversing with them freely, I never had heard in any conversation from any person, drunk or sober, the least expression of a wish for separation. Franklin was not being fully forthright. It had been 10 years since he had traveled in America, and he knew full well that a small but growing number of radical colonists, drunk and sober, desired independence. He had even begun entertaining that possibility himself. Josiah Quincy Jr., a zealous Boston patriot and son of an old Franklin friend, visited him that fall and reported that they had discussed total emancipation of the colonies as an increasingly likely outcome. The next act in the drama began with a curious invitation from a well-connected society matron who let it be known that she wanted to play chess with Franklin. The woman in question was Caroline Howe, the sister of Admiral Richard Howe and General William Howe. They would eventually end up the commanders of England's naval and land forces during the Revolution. But at the time they were both somewhat sympathetic to the American cause. Their sister was the widow of a distant cousin Richard Howe, and thus known as Mrs. Howe. When Franklin called on Mrs. Howe in early December, he found her of very sensible conversation and pleasing behavior. They enjoyed a few games, and Franklin most readily accepted an invitation to play again a few days later. This time the conversation wandered. They discussed her interest in math, which Franklin noted was a little unusual in ladies, and then Mrs. Howe turned to politics. "What is to be done?"
she asked, "about this dispute between Great Britain and her colonies?"
"They should kiss and be friends," replied Franklin.
"I have often said that I wish the government would employ you to settle the dispute," she said. "I am sure nobody could do it so well. Don't you think that the thing is practicable?"
"Undoubtedly, madam, if the parties are disposed to reconciliation," he responded. "The two countries really have no clashing interests. It was a matter that reasonable people might settle in half an hour."
He added, however, that "the ministers will never think of employing me in that good work. They choose rather to abuse me."
"Aye," she agreed, "they have behaved shamefully to you, and indeed some of them are now ashamed of it themselves."
Later that same evening, Franklin dined with two old friends, the Quakers John Fothergill and David Barclay, who made the same plea that he act as a mediator. "Put pen to paper," they urged him, "and draft a plan for reconciliation." And so he did. His hints for a conversation included 17 points. Among them, Massachusetts would pay for the destroyed tea, the tea duties would be repealed, the regulations on colonial manufacturing would be reconsidered, all money raised by trade duties would go to the colonial treasuries, no troops would be stationed in a colony without the approval of its legislature, and all powers of taxation would reside with the colonial legislatures rather than Parliament. His friends asked permission to show the list to some moderate ministers, and Franklin agreed. These private negotiations were interrupted in mid-December when Franklin finally received the resolutions that had been approved by the First Continental Congress. At its meeting in Philadelphia, which lasted until late October, the Rump Assembly had reasserted America's loyalty to the Crown, but not to Parliament. In addition, it voted a boycott of British goods if Parliament did not repeal its coercive acts. Many of the colonial agents in London refused to have anything to do with the resolutions when they arrived. So Franklin and the other agents from Massachusetts took it upon themselves to deliver them to Lord Dartmouth, who told us it was a decent and proper petition and cheerfully undertook to present it to His Majesty. On Christmas Day, Franklin visited Mrs. Howe for another chess match. As soon as he arrived, she mentioned that her brother, Admiral Lord Richard Howe, wanted to meet him.
"Will you give me leave to send for him?" she asked.
Franklin readily agreed, and soon he was listening as Lord Howe showered him with compliments.
"No man could do more towards reconciling our differences," the Admiral told him.
He asked Franklin to offer some suggestions, which he would then communicate to the proper ministers. Franklin, wary of being caught in the middle, noted that the Continental Congress had made clear what the colonies wanted. But he agreed to another secret session a week later, again under the guise of visiting Mrs. Howe to play chess. This time, the meeting was not quite as cordial. Lord Howe asked Franklin if he thought it might be useful for England to send an emissary to America to seek an accommodation. "It might be of great use," Franklin responded, "as long as the person was one of rank and dignity." Mrs. Howe interjected by nominating her brother for such a role, subtly noting that there was talk of sending over their other brother, the army general, on a less peaceful mission.
"I wish, brother, you were to be sent thither on such a service," she said. "I should like that much better than General Howe's going to command the army there."
"'I think, madam,' Franklin said pointedly, "'they ought to provide for General Howe some more honorable employment.'
Lord Howe then pulled out a piece of paper and asked if Franklin knew anything about it. It was a copy of the Hints for a Conversation that he had prepared. Franklin said that his role in drawing up the paper was supposed to be a secret, but he readily owned up to having been the originator. Howe replied that he was rather sorry to find that the propositions were Franklin's, because there was no likelihood that the ministers would accept them. He urged Franklin to reconsider the proposals and come up with a new plan that would be acceptable. Mrs. Howe could recopy it in her own hand so that the authorship would be kept secret. If Franklin did so, Lord Howe hinted, he could expect any reward in the power of the government to bestow. Franklin bristled at the implied bribe. "This, to me, was what the French call spitting in the soup," he later noted. Nevertheless, Franklin found himself trusting Lord Howe and decided to play along. "I liked his manner," he noted, "and found myself disposed to place great confidence in him." The paper he sent to Mrs. Howe the next day made no substantive concessions. Instead, it merely restated the American positions and declared them necessary to cement a cordial union. Although the talks with Howe continued fitfully through February, fueled mainly by the admiral's ambition to be chosen as an envoy, they never moved much closer to a solution. In the meantime, Franklin was engaged in a variety of other back-channel talks and negotiations, most notably with Lord Chatham. The former Prime Minister invited him to his country house to show him a series of proposals he planned to put before Parliament, and then visited him for 2 hours on Craven Street for further discussions. Lord Chatham's presence at Franklin's humble boarding house, his coach waiting very visibly in the narrow street outside the door, caused quite a stir in the neighborhood. Such a visit from so great a man on so important a business flattered not a little my vanity, Franklin admitted. It was particularly savory because it fell precisely on the first anniversary of his humiliation in the cockpit. The compromise that Chatham proposed, as the two men sat together in the tiny parlor of Mrs. Stevenson's house, would permit Parliament to regulate imperial trade and to send troops to America. But only the colonial legislatures would have the right to impose taxes, and the Continental Congress would be given official and permanent standing. Although Franklin did not approve of all its particulars, he readily agreed to lend his support by being present when Chatham presented the plan to the House of Lords on February 1st. Chatham gave an eloquent explanation of his proposals, and Lord Dartmouth responded for the government by saying they were of such weight and magnitude as to require much consideration. For a moment, Franklin felt that all of his back-channel talks and lobbying might be bearing fruit. Then Lord Sandwich, who, as First Lord of the Admiralty, had taken a hard line on colonial affairs, took the floor. In a petulant, vehement speech, he attacked Chatham's bill, and then turned his aim on Franklin. He could not believe, he said, that the plan came from the pen of an English peer. Instead, it appeared to him, the work of some American. As Franklin recounted the scene, turning his face to me, he said he fancied he had in his eye the person who drew it up, one of the bitterest and most mischievous enemies this country had ever known. This drew the eyes of many lords upon me,
but I kept my countenance as immovable as if my features had been made of wood.
Chatham replied that the plan was his own, but he was not ashamed to have consulted a person so perfectly acquainted with the whole of American affairs as the gentleman alluded to and so injuriously reflected on. He then proceeded to heap praise on Franklin, as a person whom all Europe held in high estimation for his knowledge and wisdom, and ranked with our Boyles and Newtons, who was an honor not to the English nation only, but to human nature. Franklin later wrote to his son, with perhaps a bit of feigned humility, "I found it harder to stand this extravagant compliment than the preceding equally extravagant abuse." But Chatham was not only out of power, he was out of touch. Lord Dartmouth quickly abandoned his initial openness and agreed with Lord Sandwich that the bill should be rejected immediately, which it was. "Chatham's bill," Franklin wrote to a Philadelphia friend, "was treated with as much contempt as they could have shown to a ballad offered by a drunken porter." For the next few weeks, Franklin engaged in a flurry of further meetings designed to salvage some compromise. But by early March 1775, as he finally prepared to leave England, his patience had run out. He drew up an insolent petition to Lord Dartmouth, demanding British reparations for the blockade of Boston Harbor. When he showed it to his friend and land deal partner Thomas Walpole, he looked at it and me several times alternately, as if he apprehended me a little out of my senses. Franklin returned to his senses and decided not to submit the petition. Instead, he played a small role in one of the final and most eloquent pleas for peace. He spent the afternoon of March 19th with the great Whig orator and philosopher Edmund Burke. 3 days later, Burke rose in Parliament to give his famous but futile "On Conciliation with America" speech. "A great empire and little minds go ill together," he proclaimed. By then, Franklin was already on the Philadelphia packet ship heading west from Portsmouth. He had spent his last day in London with his old friend and scientific partner Joseph Priestley. People who did not know Franklin, Priestley wrote, sometimes found him reserved, even cold. But that day, as they discussed the looming war and read from the newspapers, he grew very emotional. For a while, the tears in his eyes made it impossible for him to read. Chapter 12. Independence. Philadelphia, 1775 through 1776. Choosing sides. Just as his son William had helped him with his famed kite-flying experiment, now William's son Temple lent a hand as he lowered the homemade thermometer into the ocean. 3 or 4 times a day they would take the temperature and record it on a chart. Franklin had learned from his Nantucket cousin, the whaling captain Timothy Folger, about the course of the Gulf Stream. During the latter half of his 6-week voyage home, after writing a detailed account of his futile negotiations, Franklin turned his attention to studying it. The maps he published and the temperature measurements he made are included on the NASA website, which notes how remarkably similar they are to the infrared data gathered by modern satellites. The voyage was notably calm, but in America the long brewing storm had begun. On the night of April 18, 1775, while Franklin was in mid-ocean,
a contingent of British redcoats headed north from Boston to arrest the Tea Party planners Samuel Adams and John Hancock and capture the munitions stockpiled by their supporters. Paul Revere spread the alarm, as did others less famously. When the redcoats reached Lexington, 70 American minutemen were there to meet them.
"Disperse, ye rebels," the British major ordered. At first they did.
Then a shot was fired. In the ensuing skirmish, 8 Americans were killed. The victorious redcoats marched on to Concord, where, as Emerson put it, the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. Somehow the poor Lexington fighters lost out in Emerson's poetic version of history, just as William Dawes and other messengers got slighted in Longfellow's Paul Revere's Ride. On their day-long retreat back to Boston, more than 250 redcoats were killed or wounded by American militiamen. When Franklin landed in Philadelphia with his 15-year-old grandson on May 5th, delegates were beginning to gather there for the Second Continental Congress. Bells were rung to celebrate his arrival. "Dr. Franklin is highly pleased to find us arming and preparing for the worst events," wrote one reporter. "He thinks nothing else can save us from the most abject slavery." America was indeed arming and preparing. Among those arriving in Philadelphia that week, with his uniform packed and ready, was Franklin's old military comrade George Washington, who had become a plantation squire in Virginia after the French and Indian War. Close to 1,000 militiamen on horse and foot met him at the outskirts of Philadelphia, and a military band played patriotic songs as his carriage rode into town. Yet there was still no consensus, except among the radical patriots in the Massachusetts delegation, about whether the war that had just erupted should be waged for independence or merely for the assertion of American rights within a British empire that could still be preserved. For that question to be resolved would take another year, though not for Franklin. Franklin was selected a member of the Congress the day after his arrival. Nearing 70, he was by far the oldest. Most of the 62 others who convened in the Pennsylvania State House, such as Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry from Virginia, and John Adams and John Hancock from Massachusetts, had not even been born when Franklin first went to work there more than 40 years earlier. Franklin moved to the house on Market Street that he had designed but never known, the one where Deborah had been living without him for the past 10 years. His daughter, Sally, took care of his housekeeping needs. Her husband, Richard Bache, remained dutiful, and their two children, Ben and Will, provided amusement. "Will has got a little gun, marches with it, and whistles at the same time by way of fife," Franklin wrote. For the time being, Franklin kept quiet about whether or not he favored independence, and he avoided the taverns where the other delegates spent the evenings debating the topic. He diligently attended sessions and committee meetings, said little, and then went home to dine with his family. Beginning what would become a long and conflicted association with Franklin, the loquacious and ambitious John Adams complained that the older man was treated with reverence, even as he was sitting in silence a great part of the time fast asleep in his chair. Many of the younger, hotter-tempered delegates had never witnessed Franklin's artifice of silence, his trick of seeming sage by saying nothing. They knew him by reputation as the man who had successfully argued in Parliament against the Stamp Act, not realizing that oratory did not come naturally to him, So rumors began to circulate. What was his game? Was he a secret loyalist? Among the suspicious was William Bradford, who had taken over the printing business and newspaper of his father, Franklin's first patron and later competitor. Some of the delegates, he confided to the young James Madison, begin to entertain a great suspicion that Dr. Franklin came rather as a spy than as a friend, and that he means to discover our weak side and make his peace with the ministers. In fact, Franklin was biding his time through much of May, because there were two people, both very close to him, whom he first wanted to convert to the American rebel cause. One was Joseph Galloway, his old ally in the struggle against the Penns, who had acted as his lieutenant and surrogate for 10 years in the Pennsylvania Assembly. During the First Continental Congress, Galloway had proposed the creation of an American Congress that would have power parallel to that of Parliament, with both loyal to the king. It was a plan for an imperial union along the lines that Franklin had supported at the Albany Conference and later, but the Congress peremptorily rejected it. Sulking, Galloway had declined an appointment to the Second Continental Congress. By early 1775, Franklin had come to believe it was too late for a plan like Galloway's to work. Nevertheless, he tried to persuade Galloway to join him as a member of the new Congress. It was wrong to quit public life, he wrote, at a time when your abilities are so much wanted. Initially, he also gave Galloway no more clue than he had given others about where he stood on the question of independence. People seemed at a loss what party he would take, Galloway later recalled. The other person Franklin hoped to convert to the revolutionary cause was someone even closer to him. The Summit at Trevo's. New Jersey Governor William Franklin, still loyal to the British ministry and embroiled in disputes with his own legislature, read of his father's return to Philadelphia in the papers. It was, he wrote Strawn, quite unexpected news to me. He was eager to meet with his father and to reclaim his son Temple. First, however, he had to endure a special session of the New Jersey legislature he had called for May 15th. Shortly after it ended in rancor, the three generations of Franklins, father and son and a poor grandson caught in the middle, were finally reunited. Franklin and his son chose a neutral venue for their summit. Trevo's, the grand fieldstone manor house of Joseph Galloway in Bucks County, just north of Philadelphia. Surprisingly, given the intensely emotional nature of the meeting, neither they nor Galloway apparently ever wrote about it. The only source for what transpired is, ironically, the diary of Thomas Hutchinson, the Massachusetts governor whose letters Franklin had purloined. In his diary, Hutchinson recorded an account of the meeting Galloway gave 3 years later, when both men were exiled loyalists in England. The evening started awkwardly, with embraces and then small talk. At one point, William pulled Galloway aside to say that he had avoided, until now, seriously talking politics with his father. But after a while, the glass having gone around freely and much Madeira consumed, they confronted their political disagreements. "Well, Mr. Galloway," Franklin asked his longtime ally, "you are really of the mind that I ought to promote a reconciliation?" Galloway was indeed of such a mind, but Franklin would hear none of it. He had brought with him the long letter he had written to William during his Atlantic crossing, which detailed his futile attempts at negotiating a reconciliation. Although Galloway had already heard portions of it, Franklin again read most of it aloud and told of the abuse he had suffered. Galloway volleyed with his own horror stories about how anonymous radicals had sent him a noose for proposing a plan to save the British Union. A revolution, he stressed, would be suicidal. William argued that it was best for them all to remain neutral, but his father was not moved. As Hutchinson later recorded, he opened himself and declared in favor of measures for attaining to independence, and exclaimed against the corruption and dissipation of the kingdom. William responded with anger, but also with a touch of concern for his father's safety. If he intended to set the colonies in flame, William hoped he should take care to run away by the light of it. So William rode back to New Jersey, defeated and dejected, to resume his duties as royal governor. With him was his son Temple. The one issue that Benjamin and William had settled at Trevose was that the boy would spend the summer in New Jersey, then return to Philadelphia to be enrolled in the college his grandfather had founded there. William had hoped to send him to King's College, now Columbia, in New York, but Benjamin scuttled that plan because it had become a hotbed of English loyalism. Temple was soon to be caught in a tug of war between two men who vied for his loyalty. He eagerly sought to please them both, but he was fated to find that impossible. Franklin the Rebel. It is hard to pinpoint precisely when America crossed the threshold of deciding that complete independence from Britain was necessary and desirable. It is even difficult